Good morning. I'm Matt Schaefer. Welcome back to the Boston Sunday Review. What if food could be traded in a way that is honest and fair, that empowers both farmers and consumers? That's the goal behind the Equal Exchange Fair Trade Cooperative. Rodney North of Equal Exchange joins us here on the Boston Sunday Review. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me today.
And your official title is, I love it on your card, The Answer Man, information for the public and media. So are you one of those people that if I ever go on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you should be one of my phone at home friends?
If the questions have anything to do with food, farming, trade, or business, yeah,
the
maybe.
Answer would be yes.
Yeah.
Your story, or the story of fair trade, begins in 1986. What was the food world like back then?
It was a sea change from, well, we've had a sea change in the world of food since then. Basically, it was anonymous. We didn't know where anything came from. You didn't know where your meat came from. All the conversation we have now about local or sustainable or organic farming, direct from the farmer, just none of that was happening. And the three founders of Equal Exchange were in the food business. They were beginning, they and some people like them were beginning to make some steps, like trying to work with New England farmers. But certainly nobody was thinking about this on the global scale, like where did my coffee come from?
So tell us about the trio of Equal Exchange founders. Who were they, and how did they meet?
So it was Rink Dickinson, Jonathan Rosenthal, and Michael Rosine, and they were all working with a business that became known as Northeast. It was a business owned by stores. So it'd be like small grocery stores. Harvest Cooperative here in the Boston area was one of the owners. There were businesses around New England that owned it. And Northeast would be the distributor to all these businesses.
And a distributor of food products?
Right, right.
How old were these guys?
They were just in their 20s.
Okay.
And so they were learning the business from the inside, doing all the sourcing, whether it was produce or international goods like rice and coffee, and then distributing it to what was then a very fledgling natural foods industry.
So did these guys know each other before, or did they meet on the job?
So they met
on the job.
Yeah, but they were all from either, well, at the time, going to school in New England or were already from New England.
Once a week, I'm told, they would meet to talk about social change and what they could do and sort of to talk about being on the job.
Yeah, so even though they're in the middle of this business, they were very politically aware. The 80s were, in parts of the world, well, really 60s, 70s, and 80s, a time of revolution. You had nations like in Africa that were gaining their independence. There were civil wars in Central America over really deep political issues. And they were aware of the stuff. They were following it. And they were kind of connecting some of those themes with what they were doing. You know, a really basic thing, right? You know, buying and distributing food.
It's so interesting because today, you know, in 2013, we are so interested in who's farming and where you're getting your food from and the farm-to-table phenomenon. But back then, none of this existed. So when these guys were thinking about, well, gosh, who farmed my coffee, for example, they really had no idea the conditions that coffee farmer or coffee farmers were dealing with in order to get the coffee that was ending up here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah. And also from some travel, like one of them had traveled to Sri Lanka, others have traveled to Latin America. Yeah, they could see what later the rest of us would see, right? They were saying, oh, this is what it takes to get simply a bag of coffee from Nicaragua or Peru up here to Boston. They didn't like what they saw. It was pretty grim. And it's true for a lot of things. The closer you look, there's some ugly truths behind them.
So these three guys, it's my understanding, came up with some kind of highfalutin ideas that they would like to see put into practice. And one of them was that they would like to be able to help these farmers and their families gain more control over their economic futures. Yes?
Yes, for sure. And I wouldn't use the phrase highfalutin, but certainly idealistic.
Okay.
and ambitious. It was, you know, we throw around the phrase sometimes at Equal Exchange about, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. So they saw this unpretty reality about how coffee got to market and the tough lives of these small coffee farmers, and thought, okay, can we do better than this?
What's the concept of fair trade premiums?
So, well, the premium is one part of a fair trade platform. There are many elements to a fair trade platform, and fair trade had already existed in handicrafts with businesses like 10,000 Villages. That goes back really to the 40s, and their idea, and other people in Europe were having the similar idea, was, okay, If we can make up our own international trade system, how would we want it to run such that the little guy has a chance and gets a little more out of the consumer's dollar? So the first part is a guaranteed floor price. You can think about it kind of like a minimum wage, that these commodities all have huge booms and busts, and it really stresses the farmers. What if we can put a floor under that so that the price never goes too low? The premium would be a little extra payment on top of what's normally paid for the coffee. And the coffee farmers community, usually farmer cooperatives, can take this extra payment and do stuff like build clinics or build a quality control lab, which give them a higher quality product to sell in the market. They really spend it however they want. And there are about three other components of fair trade: trading directly, so Equal Exchange buying from these farmer co-ops, and long-term relationships. Typically, in the commodities trades, it's all a one-night stand. And you could be a wheat farmer in Nebraska or a coffee farmer in Peru. You know, there was at the time, it was unknown for there being any sort of long-term relationship. And fair trade would say, no, we can do better. We're going to stick it out with these folks.
Additionally, the founders wanted to educate consumers about the trade issues that were affecting the farmers.
Yes, exactly. And so, like at the time, so Nicaragua was our first source of coffee, and its number one export was coffee. Number one market was the U.S. The Bush and Reagan administrations had put an embargo. And so through our importation of this coffee, we were able to raise issues about, hey, you know, these small farmers are just being caught up in this big trade battle, and they shouldn't be the victims of like these big geopolitical struggles.
At the same time, did the farmers come up with the founders come up with the idea of doing this as a cooperative?
Yeah, and this is, I was saying how they were idealistic and ambitious, and
which are better words than highfalutin.
So they were looking at the whole model, not just, okay, can we get more money to these farmers? Can we educate the public? But okay, we're going to have a little business, you know, if we're lucky. If it succeeds, how do we want to operate internally? And so they adopted the cooperative model, which would basically be applying democratic principles inside the workplace.
And the workplace would be worker-controlled.
Worker-controlled, also worker-owned. And so now we have 125 employees. Over 100 of us are owners.
And how does the concept of cooperative, worker-controlled, and worker-owned differ from nonprofit?
Well, for one thing, we are for profit. We pay taxes. We have to pay our own way. You know, we only, like any for profit, we have to consistently provide good value to all of our customers and to earn our keep, pay our taxes, so we can keep doing this year after year.
So, how much money did they need to raise to as an initial investment?
Yeah. So, obviously, in this situation, they're entrepreneurs. With this crazy, you know, idealistic business plan, they raised about $100,000, really from friends and family. At the time, it just seemed like a good way to throw away money because it was such an unheard of thing. People weren't talking about any of this stuff. There was no market for it. They would have to go create a fair trade market.
And as you said, the initial product that they came up with was Nicaraguan coffee. Why?
So there was what I was saying before about in the 80s, there was this fight between Nicaragua and the U.S. The Nicaraguans had overthrown a dictator, Somoza, in 79. A socialist government came into power. They were at odds with the Reagan administration. An embargo was set up, really strangling that country, and the farmers were caught in the middle.
And so did you guys go out or the founders go out? Well, you were on there pretty early.
I came along 10 years later. Okay. So, yeah, I've been there 17 years.
How did they locate the original coffee growers? And wasn't importing Nicaraguan coffee illegal back then?
Illegal probably too strong a word. There was an embargo against it. However, if you read the law carefully, a Nicaraguan product that went somewhere else, like Amsterdam, was roasted, like green coffee gets roasted in Amsterdam, packaged, it would then become a Dutch product. There was no problem bringing in a Dutch product. So we were importing this Nicaraguan coffee that had been roasted packages in the Netherlands, brought that in, and that did raise some concerns in the Bush senior administration. And then it got to be a political struggle about should this coffee be shut down. And that was actually the first big kind of coming out party for equal exchange, this tussle with the administration.
And within a few years, you were part of the European Fair Trade Network.
Yeah, European Fair Trade Association, which was one of the first times that a bunch of people who were promoting this fair trade idea got together to work together. We had to join the European one because there wasn't yet one in the United States. Later, we would be one of the founding members of the U.S.-based Fair Trade Federation, which still exists today.
And you expanded from coffee to tea.
Yeah, in the late 80s, we were working with growers in Sri Lanka. Tea didn't work initially. We tried all kinds of things, actually. Coffee, thanks to the specialty coffee boom, right? You know, we had the coffee connection in Starbucks. Coffee was our product that took off. Later, in the 90s, late 90s, we went back to tea again. And since then, we've been just adding new products almost about every year.
You've expanded to the Dominican Republic and chocolate. Then you added bananas and nuts, and now olive oil, and you've got a whole bunch of stuff that you brought with you to show what you have.
Yeah, sure. So here I have a sample of the organic.
Okay, there's the olive oil.
And I will, for you and Tucker, I'll give you some of this. This is our caramel sea salt chocolate bar, which is probably our most popular. It's been a big success.
Okay, thank you. Tucker, here's some chocolate.
Yeah.
Tucker's engineering the show this morning.
And
oh, it's really good.
Thank you.
Both caramely and salty.
Yes, yeah. The sweet salt combination along with chocolate is pretty much a slam dunk winner. Yeah, so now we actually have over 10 flavors of chocolate. We have a new line of 3 candy bars, which are really popular, like, for schools, kids. We have 9 different teas, probably 40 different coffees. There was the bananas that you were just talking about, cocoa powder, baking cocoa. And the big new thing is, be another first, we've had a whole series of firsts, is the first line of fair trade fruit and nuts, dried fruit, which will be coming out later this spring.
So how many products do you guess from how many farmers in how many countries?
It's interesting. I did a staff meeting about this not long ago. When you add it all up, it's actually we're sourcing directly or indirectly from 75 farmer cooperatives, which together represent many tens of thousands of small-scale farmers from over 40 countries.
How and where do you source out your products?
Some we do in partnerships. We're working now with a great group in the UK. They're also a fair trade pioneer called Tradecraft. And like they're helping with these cereal bars called Geo Bars. And they're helping with the dried fruit and nuts. But the vast majority we're doing directly. And this is another one of our places where we were out in front of the market was, instead of going through brokers and importers, we were our own importer, traveling to Ecuador, Peru, Mexico, and establishing these direct relationships with the farmer cooperatives ourselves. And that's especially true for the coffee, sugar, cacao, bananas, tea.
And Rodney, what does it mean to the farmers?
It's a really big deal. I could talk for a couple hours about why these farmers are poor and have these small little lots and why they have no power in the marketplace. And basically, whether it's political or social or certainly in the marketplace commercially, everything is stacked against them. It's like the American small farmer, but 10 times worse. So we and people like us are this like one sliver of opportunity where they get a leg up. Instead of trying to like crush their cooperatives, which is what some of the local elites have tried to do in places like southern Mexico, we actually try to provide financing and try to provide this stability where they know not just that they've sold something this year, but we're going to be there again next year and the year after, which gives them a chance to make plans and make investments. And it gives them a little breathing room. People talk about the poverty trap. You know, like you're too poor to get out of your poverty. You can't make investments. You can't educate your kids. So by putting a little more money in the pocket of the farmers and a little more money into these communities, they can get a teacher for the empty schoolhouse, you know? They can make those kinds of
bootstrapping efforts. Do your people actually go there, meet the farmers? Is there an ongoing relationship?
Yeah, in fact, you can call it a perk of our job or an obligation. Every full-time employee at Equal Exchange will go on one of these trips to spend up to 5 days at origin, as we say. So in a farming community in El Salvador or in Ecuador. But many of us are going down regularly. Two of my neighbors, they buy the green beans and they do the quality control. And they're probably on the road a good 2 or 3 months a year. And in fact, we've got this fantastic video we just put up. So it's equalexchange.coop/expedition. And it's a 3-minute video and a 6-minute video of one of our recent trips down to Peru, this amazingly remote place. So people can get a flavor of what it's like to have these direct relationships with these farmers.
You mentioned that when you got started, there was no Fair Trade USA. But I'm curious, given the agro business, is there a need or demand for a domestic fair trade program?
Well, we've been trying to work on that. There actually now is something called the Domestic Fair Trade Association. Its headquarters actually here in Boston. We were a founding member of that. And starting around 2007, we and others like Organic Valley, the dairy cooperative, and Dr. Bronner's, were trying to find a way to apply the fair trade model to benefit American farmers and farm workers. In fact, one of the founders of Equal Exchange, Michael Rosine, this is over 10, 12 years ago, he actually left Equal Exchange to try to apply these principles. He has a great organization. It is a nonprofit called Red Tomato, redtomato.org. And they're applying these ideas in a slightly different way to connect like New England farmers, Northeastern farmers really, with Northeastern markets. And they're having a lot of success with that. But domestic fair trade is certainly far behind where we are with internationally imported fair trade goods like bananas and coffee.
Who ensures that a product labeled as fair trade really is indeed fairly traded?
Sure. So for the long time, we were the fair trade market for food, coffee and tea. Only later in the late 90s did a certifier come along. And we had the same thing with organic. You have the practice, and then the certifiers and auditors come along later for just the reasons you were mentioning. And now there's at least, sometimes it's hard to keep track, of 4 different certifications. One, there's a relatively newer one called Fairtrade International US. They provide a certification. There's one called IMO, which we use for some products. There's a really new one, which is actually run by small farmer groups themselves. We refer to it as the SPP. The first one in the U.S. was called Transfair. It's still around. It has a new name.
And has the United States interest in food and cooking and farmers markets and farm to table worked for your advantage?
Oh, for sure. And well, I think it's fair. We can take some credit for creating interest in the market that we now serve. Certainly, we were we were ahead of the curve. We were trying to do it when it was a really hard sell and people weren't interested in this stuff. Now they are. So now we have hundreds of competitors who are also selling a little or a fair amount of fair trade products. So we still have to, we've kind of created our competition. But in fact, this is something we wanted. We wanted to demonstrate that it didn't have to be a dog-eat-dog kind of market, that you could be deliver a high-quality product that worked for the farmers, that was competitively priced. And so now, yeah, you got hundreds of either coffee roasters and others doing this. But we're still growing. We've been growing every year for 27 years.
Really, I was going to say the cooperative is healthier than ever. You're based in West Bridgewater, right?
Yeah.
But you are the world's first ever worker-owned co-op to span thousands of miles.
We may still be the only one that we know of. So, yeah, we started here, but now, and it's kind of the nature of our business that we need people nationwide. So we have about 15 people in Portland and Seattle. I got a colleague in Sacramento. We have an office warehouse in St. Paul. And we have others in Maine and Atlanta. And we don't think any worker co-op has done this before.
So how many members of the co-op?
We're over 100. I think we're up to about 105 now, which makes us probably like the third or fourth largest worker cooperative in the country.
And you, I understand, are the fourth most senior worker?
I guess I am, yeah.
Does seniority have its benefits?
A lot of more junior people ask me a lot of questions, which I'm very happy to answer. It is a very rare kind of business. Whether you're looking at the fair trade, you're looking at the employee ownership and governance.
Right.
And also, a lot of people don't realize that it's actually rare to have a successful long-term small food brand. Most of them get gobbled up, when they're still tiny, and we're still independent. We're not owned by, Cargill or Nestle or anybody.
Are you still on the board?
I'm not anymore. I served two terms, and that was a great, rare privilege. How many people are on the board of their company?
You guys practice open book management.
Yes.
What is that?
That's a slightly more common practice, which is catching on, and that's really... And I was surprised that other people can't do this. So our finances are all open. What were the revenues? What were the margins? What were the profits? How much debt do we have? All of this kind of stuff. And it's not just that the books are open. And we talk about these basic financials every 2 weeks at our staff meetings, but the board meetings are open. It's really applying kind of basic democratic practices.
You embrace a one worker, one vote philosophy. Does it work, and what are staff meetings like?
Now, there's a distinction between staff meetings, which is kind of like the business side of it, versus cooperative meetings. That's where we get together, and we're all wearing our owner's hat, where, like, you're an owner, I'm an owner, the founder, we're all owners with an equal voice, equal say. Staff meetings are more like, okay, we got directors and managers and rank-and-file employees, and we give reports from departments. And one of the things that's made it so successful— And I have to repeat, we've grown every year for 27 years. We've been in the black for 22 of the last 23 years. We've, like I said, we have over 100 worker owners, and we're doing well in all of our categories. One of the things that's helped is that we understand that sometimes you're an employee. Like I do PR. Other people, they buy green beans, they buy tea, they package, they do accounts receivable. You have your employee role, and another time you're an owner. It's like, okay, I am a part owner of this business, and we bear some responsibility to make sure that we're serving our mission, like the farmers, and that we're running a good ship financially.
When did you open the cafe?
Thank you for reminding me to talk about that. So we've now had... I think it's been at least 3 years.
This is the cafe next to the garden.
Exactly. Down the garden, 225 Causeway Street. And So I think it was 3 years ago. That's been really successful.
And you not only have the cafe, but you have little sort of trikes that go up and down the Rose Kennedy Greenway. Little food trucks or trikes.
Yeah, you're right, right. So a three-wheeled bike, so we call it a trike, and on the back, these are custom made in Somerville by a great group, I think called Pedal Power, and we basically put the innards of a cafe on a trike, and you'll find it like at the MGH subway stop and other places around town, and that's been a fun way of getting out into the community, serving coffee, selling coffee, without having to build a brick and mortar cafe.
So where can folks buy fair trade products in Boston, and do you have, or what is your logo? How do they know it's you?
Yeah, well, go
and
ahead.
What can they buy?
Yeah, well, there's all the different products we talked about.
Let's talk about them again.
So, and almost all of it's organic, by the way, and certainly all of it's fair trade. Coffee, tea, chocolate, cocoa, a little bit of sugar, olive oil, coming up, fruit and nuts. Already out there are candy bars. And I'm probably forgetting something. I'm going to regret it. But also, besides the
You have a logo on them?
Yes. It's a red rectangle with white lettering. If you go to equalexchange.coop, you'll see that. You'll see it on all of our products. As far as where you can find it.
Right.
Well, anywhere that people are, there's our online store, shop.equalexchange.com. But people like Harvest, our chocolate bars, Harvest Cooperative Markets and JP in Cambridge, their Foodies Market, our chocolates and cocoa can be found at Whole Foods Market. City Feed and Supply is a fantastic account in JP. And there's some other locations. Basically, if you look for it in your local stores, and if it's not there, you can ask for it. But a lot of people actually find us through their place of worship or through their school.
Because you have a very active interfaith program.
We do. And even though, you know, we're a secular organization, but because of these ideals that we've been able to put into place, 12 different faith-based groups have endorsed us and promote us to their communities.
And finally, this is, you guys believe, a win-win situation for everybody.
Sure, and like everybody believes in fair play, but sometimes in the marketplace, that gets kind of shunted to the side. And we found that, yeah, you actually can, you know, live your ideals, even as business people, put it into place, and even when you're dealing with the most disadvantaged, like these small farmers and developing countries, you can put it into place. It comes back in spades. You know, we pay the best prices. We get the best product. The farmers are very loyal to us. We try to treat ourselves well internally as a worker cooperative. So we have great employee loyalty and enthusiasm.
And you're selling some really great and delicious chocolate, olive oil, nuts, bananas,
and
other products.
Yeah, and you know, because we're for profit, we have to compete. We're competing with the Starbucks and the Dole bananas and the Hershey's, and so we have to, like I said, earn our customers' loyalty. And I think we deliver. And you know, the fact that we grow every year suggests that people think we're delivering something not just ethically reassuring. But tasty.
So look for the red Equal Exchange label on the products. Rodney North of Equal Exchange Fair Trade, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Once again, the website is equalexchange.coop. You're listening to the Boston Sunday Review.